You can now find all of C-SPAN's nonfiction-focused podcasts in one place, the C-SPAN Bookshelf feed. Follow now, and you'll get all of C-SPAN's podcasts that are nonfiction book-related every week. I'm Shannon.
And I'm Rachel. And as part of the podcast team here at C-SPAN, we wanted to make it easy for our nonfiction book lovers to access all of our offerings in one place.
Hear from authors like Kidada Williams on her book, I Saw Death Coming, Joan Biskupic and her latest, Nine Black Robes, or Neil King, who shared his walking journey from D.C. to New York City in his book, American Ramble.
Featured programs will include Book Notes Plus, Q&A, Afterwards, and About Books. You can follow the C-SPAN Bookshelf feed wherever you get your podcasts.
In this weekend's episode, three interviews from this week's Washington Journal. First, author, law professor, and ABC News legal contributor Kim Whaley discusses former President Trump's indictment in connection with his handling of classified national security records. Then, NBC News senior congressional correspondent Scott Wong on House conservatives' revolt against GOP leadership over its handling of the debt limit vote. Plus, Military Times deputy editor Leo Shane about how the recent debt limit deal might impact the coming battle over defense spending. We begin with a discussion about the indictment against former President Donald Trump and the legal and constitutional issues at hand.
Kim Whaley is a visiting law professor at American University. She is a legal contributor to ABC News, also served as a former U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney, and here to join us to walk through the events of yesterday. Kim Whaley, welcome back to Washington Journal.
Thank you for having me.
From that former assistant U.S. attorney point of view, tell us what you think about yesterday's events.
Given what we know about what's even public, it sounds like there's a strong case on the facts that Special Counsel Jack Smith has gathered. So I think many of us anticipated this coming, we don't know what's actually in the indictment. It sounds like Mr. Trump and his lawyers haven't even seen it yet, but it's frankly not a big surprise.
Can you tell us what gets us to this point, even use of an indictment itself, especially when it comes to activity with the grand jury?
Right. So one of the surprises this week was that there are two grand juries relating to the Mar-a-Lago investigation. That is, you know, Donald Trump's taking classified information out of the White House and then not returning it for 18 months. That's really the critical factual distinction between him and, say, former Vice President Mike Pence, and Joe Biden, who also were found having possessed records in their private homes after having left office. And so there's two grand juries, one in D.C. that's been ongoing, not just dealing with Mar-a-Lago, but also with the January 6th insurrection events that Jack Smith is spearheading. And we found out that the second one is in Florida. And the reason the second one likely is in Florida and that the indictment is coming out of Florida has to do with a legal concept known as venue. That is, you can't charge someone in a state that has no nexus or nothing to do with the activity that gives rise to the indictment. So presumably, the indictment will contain information regarding alleged wrongdoing that Mr. Trump did in the state of Florida. And that's the connection, that's the venue, that's why the grand jury, presumably out of Florida, is the one that is issuing this indictment.
So walk us again, now take us forward to next Tuesday about expectations there.
So he's supposed to be in court on Tuesday, and this is typical for anyone who has been indicted or charged through another kind of document would be an information. An indictment comes specifically from a grand jury, and grand jurors are just regular people, your neighbors, your friends that get called to sit and listen to evidence. Sometimes the grand jury just listens to evidence and doesn't do anything with it. It's just an investigative grand jury. It's there to just gather facts. Sometimes they're asked to actually make a charging determination, and that's apparently what happened here. Tuesday, Mr. Trump will at some point be formally arrested. I know that's a scary word, but we saw this happen with Alvin Bragg out of Manhattan. I'm sure his lawyers and the government are negotiating around that to happen sort of smoothly and without a whole lot of incident. He would be fingerprinted and booked, and then there'll be a an initial hearing at which presumably he'd be arraigned. And what that means is he'll formally hear the charges. They'll be read to him. That's basic due process. You have to have notice of what the government says that you did wrong. And then he, through his counsel, will enter a plea. Presumably not guilty. And then the judge, and I understand it's the same judge that issued the warrant to search Mar-a-Lago, it's a magistrate judge, that judge will talk to Trump's counsel about the conditions of his release between now and trial, and possibly, in addition, questions around confidentiality. Because one of the things here is this indictment, it sounds like it involves national security information, classified information. We don't know if it's actually listed in the indictment, but I'm sure there are sensitivities, not just around the fact that it's a former president, but around the subject matter of this case that is, classified information that really shouldn't be out in the public domain, even through the court system.
There's reporting taking a look at some of the laws that these potential charges might stem from. Wanted to ask you about those and kind of walk you through a couple of them. That provision of the Espionage Act being one of them, which prohibits that retention of classified materials. Can you expand on that? And what possibly could it mean in this case?
Yeah, so that the Espionage Act is, I think, a post-World War I statute, and it doesn't actually talk about classified information. It talks about national defense information, because at that time there wasn't such a thing as classified information. But this is sort of the go-to place for people that are leaking classified information mishandling, abusing classified information that belongs to the United States. So that's kind of a big charge, because it's not just taking information from the White House, and we can talk about that, the Presidential Records Act. You know, just to be clear, when a president leaves office under a statute called the Presidential Records Act, which was enacted after Watergate, after the shenanigans with former President Nixon, when he leaves office, his records officially belong. They transfer sort of possession and ownership of them to the United States people, the American people. So when he left office, none of those records were he was allowed to keep. And then you have another level. Okay, well, if some of those records were classified, that triggers this other concern, the Espionage Act, which, you know, this is why this is such a serious case, is that's the kind of information that could actually compromise national security. Now, we don't know what's in the indictment, but that's what makes it a more serious offense, is because it involves potentially national security information.
And then another statute that takes a look at the obstruction of an official proceeding. How does that apply in this case?
Two real parts to the story. One is the taking of the documents. And the second is the fact that over, I think, 18 months, the National Archives and then the FBI asked Mr. Trump and his lawyers and his associates and aides to return the documents. And the government was told on more than one occasion that they had received everything, when it turns out once the warrant was executed, there were additional hundreds of documents at Mar-a-Lago. So obstruction, we've heard obstruction in connection with the Mueller report way back when. There were 10 alleged acts of obstruction of justice by Donald Trump when he was president. We've heard about obstruction in connection with January 6th. Basically, those sets of statutes are about this. Once a criminal investigation is underway, we don't want to have people get away with thwarting it by hiding evidence, by bribing witnesses, by tampering with witnesses, threatening them, threatening the judge, harassing the jury. All those kinds of things are illegal, because if they were legal, we would not have a criminal justice system that functions. So the obstruction part of this case presumably has to do with reports that documents were moved around, boxes were moved, et cetera. You know, there's even a report out of CNN that there's suspicious flooding of a room that contained surveillance recordings relating to where the documents were. We don't know if that's accurate or not, but any of those kinds of things that were designed to hide or conceal the stuff and keep it from the federal government, once it became clear that Donald Trump hadn't turned everything over, that's a separate charge.
That was Kim Whaley, former assistant U.S. attorney, law professor, and ABC News legal analyst. Next, NBC News senior congressional correspondent Scott Wong discusses how the revolt by House conservatives impacted legislative business this week and what's next.
The House is not conducting any business at all. The House is in a stalemate. As you've discussed on this program already, there were 11 conservative lawmakers, most of them members of the Freedom Caucus, including as well as Matt Gaetz, the congressman from Florida. These are all conservative rabble-rousers. These are individuals who have been at odds with McCarthy. Many of them oppose Kevin McCarthy for Speaker. Leadership in this case was blindsided when 11 of these individuals joined hands with Democrats and blocked a procedural vote, a vote on a rule on the floor. It took everybody by surprise, including myself and many other longtime congressional watchers and reporters. This had not happened since 2002, so more than 20 years ago, that a rule had not been taken down on the floor and blocked. It basically blocked these four pieces of GOP legislation from advancing forward, and it froze the House floor. We have been in a stalemate for the past 2 days now. Nothing has moved as Kevin McCarthy has tried to negotiate, to try to break an impasse with these conservative rebels. And it's a very peculiar situation because Republicans are in the majority, but it is members of that majority, just a handful, that have ground the House of Representatives to a halt.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the House Freedom Caucus members, kind of plus Matt Gaetz, who, from what we understand, technically isn't a House Freedom Caucus member.
Right.
Who are they? Kind of what do they represent as far as what do they want? Where are they coming from on this?
Right. The Freedom Caucus was created back in 2015. This would have been in the John Boehner era. And they really came out of the Tea Party movement of 2010. Some of the more prominent members who have risen to high positions in recent years include Mark Meadows, who was one of the Freedom Caucus founders. Meadows is significant because he was first well known because he brought a motion to vacate of trying to force a vote to remove then Speaker John Boehner. That vote never happened, but eventually John Boehner, facing enormous pressure, was forced to resign. Meadows went on to become the chief of staff for then-President Trump. There are a number of other significant figures from the Freedom Caucus who rose to high positions. Jim Jordan, who is now the judiciary chairman, Mick Mulvaney, who also served as a chief of staff for President Trump. So these are folks on the far right who were constantly creating headaches for their leadership. This new iteration is also continuing to cause headaches for now Speaker Kevin McCarthy. And in fact, the Freedom Caucus, back in 2015, when John Boehner resigned, Kevin McCarthy stepped up to run for Speaker of the House, if you remember, and the Freedom Caucus was the ones who blocked Kevin McCarthy at that time from becoming Speaker, paving the way for Speaker Paul Ryan. So the leadership and the Freedom Caucus have been at odds, at each other's throats for years and years, and this is just the latest iteration of this long-standing conflict between these two groups.
What do we know? What these members behind the stalemate, there are 11 right now.
Right.
What do they want? What have they been asking for as they've met with those Republican leaders over the last couple of days?
Well, we know what they're upset about. They're upset about the fact that they believe there was some kind of arrangement or a deal with Kevin McCarthy back when he was negotiating the Speaker's gavel. You remember those 15 rounds of voting where Kevin McCarthy could not win the race for Speaker. They say that he had promised them that spending caps would be reduced to fiscal year 2022 levels. That was not what the spending caps look like in this latest debt deal with President Biden, the McCarthy-Biden deal, the Fiscal Responsibility Act. They did not cut spending that low. And so they're upset about what they perceive as that breach of a contract with Kevin McCarthy. McCarthy says, well, that was aspirational. That was the goal. That was what we were trying to do, but I never put it in, set it in stone that we were going to get there. Okay, so separately, they are upset with what they perceive to be retaliation against one of their own members, Andrew Clyde, who you know well from Georgia. He had a bill that he's been trying to get a vote on the floor, a bill for pistol that would protect pistol stabilizing braces for weapons. And so he believes that because he voted against a rule on the debt ceiling, that he was facing retaliation, that the leadership was trying to block his bill from coming to the floor. Leadership says, well, we've worked it out. A vote is scheduled on Andrew Clyde's bill for next Tuesday. Andrew Clyde acknowledges that. So that issue seems to be resolved, although there are some members that are still bringing up the Andrew Clyde issue as one of the main reasons why they're holding up the floor. And so this all goes back to spending. And so what these guys want, it seems, is further reductions to spending. However, the challenge is that we already have this deal between McCarthy and Biden in this debt deal that establishes spending levels for the next couple of years. So it's really hard to reopen those negotiations. Furthermore, McCarthy came out and talked to reporters last night after a long series of meetings and said, you know, it's not entirely clear what the specific asks are from these Freedom Caucus members, from these conservatives. You talk to 11 different members, they're all saying different things. And so it's very nebulous. And that's part of the problem why they were unable to come to a resolution last night.
So I want to get to one more point before we go to calls. Punchbowl News this morning has an interview with Steve Scalise, who's the Republican leader, basically the second in command to Kevin McCarthy, but they aren't necessarily close buds. And so in Punchbowl News this morning, it says, they report, we asked Scalise if McCarthy has broken any promises to conservative. Scalise's reply provides insight into the current state of the House GOP leadership. The short answer, it's not good. Here's how Scalise responded, quote, I don't know. I don't know what the promises were. I wasn't part of that, so I still don't know what those agreements were. Whatever they are, conservatives feel that the agreements were broken. That's got to get resolved. Hopefully it does. That just doesn't seem that there's a rift possibly growing. You say you can tell us a little bit about that history between Scalise and McCarthy.
Well, McCarthy was always tenuous that McCarthy was going to get to the speakership all of these years, especially after 2015 when he dropped out of the speaker's race and was wounded by the Freedom Caucus. There always was a big question mark hanging over McCarthy's head. Could he get there? And because Scalise was the number two official behind McCarthy all of these years, that he was seen as a possible alternative to Kevin McCarthy. And so there had been a rivalry that developed between these two men, although they are part of the same GOP leadership team and have to work together on legislation and how to bring bills to the floor and round up votes. Steve Scalise, for a long time, actually both men served as the GOP whip, so they both know the whipping operation. But there's a long history between these two individuals, and we are seeing, you know, they had sort of made their peace after Kevin McCarthy rose to the speakership earlier this year, but that rivalry still seems to be there. And now, because we're in this situation where nothing is moving on the House floor, there is a lot of finger pointing, it seems, between these two camps. And so, you know, I think that's a little bit of what we're seeing. If you read between the lines of some of the comments that McCarthy has made, that Scalise has made, there's a little bit of a blame game happening in this current impasse on the House floor.
That was NBC's senior congressional correspondent Scott Wong. Finally, Military Times deputy editor Leo Shane previews the upcoming battle on Capitol Hill over military spending and how the recent debt limit deal plays into it.
First, this issue of military spending. We saw late last week that it almost derailed the negotiations over the debt limit bill. Remind viewers what happened and how that was solved so the deal could eventually pass the Senate and be signed into law.
Yeah, look, the end negotiation there was allowing about a 3% increase in defense spending for fiscal 2024. It's $886 billion. I mean, this has been one of the key fights is if there's going to be a cut to government spending or if there's going to be hold flat, if government spending will be held flat, should defense be exempt from that? And there's quite a few Republicans and centrist Democrats who have said we just can't afford to pull back on defense spending. Even that number, even that 3% increase has come under fire because it doesn't quite keep up with inflation. So, national security has always been an area where Congress has loved to add extra money and has been reluctant to pull back. So with the debt limit deal, they've got a number. We sort of felt like that was settled going ahead into the budget information. But at the last minute, as you mentioned in the Senate, there was a real big fight over whether or not there'll need to be a defense supplemental, even more money put into defense next year. We'll have to see where that shakes out. There isn't a deal right now. There was at least some conversation on the Senate floor, some signals from Leader Schumer that he'd be maybe receptive to the idea. But yesterday we heard from the House Speaker saying he's not interested in a supplemental. He wants to make sure that the defense spending dollar figure is what they negotiated in the debt limit deal. So not as settled as we thought it might be. It's going to be interesting to see over the next few months just how much wiggle room there is in what that deal was.
And that number again, $886 billion was the number negotiated, the highest defense budget in U.S. history, the largest in the world. Mm-hmm. Coming back to supplementals, can we just explain what a supplemental is? Why does it get to be counted outside the normal budgeting process?
Yeah, look, I mean, that's essentially all it is taking, saying, hey, we need extra money here, but we're not going to put it into the budget process. We're not going to do it. We're going to do this as an extra. So we've seen this for a number of different things. Some of the COVID spending was there, Afghanistan, the war on terror funds. That was considered outside. And the logic behind it was if we've got a target for defense spending as a whole, we don't want that to eat into all the things that are in there, the military pay raise, the recapitalization, buying new equipment. So when you're looking at the ceilings that Congress has set under the debt limit deal, the idea is if you have something like Ukraine, and this is one of the flashpoints that I'm sure we'll talk about a little more, several billion dollars for that. If you put that into the defense budget, does that take away from pilots' training time? Does it take away from purchases of other defense equipment? If you have it outside, it doesn't count. It doesn't matter. You can just have it over here and you're doing some fun accounting. But it does play into the debt. It's not like that money just disappears. It is charged against the country.
You bring up Ukraine. Is all the money that has come out of the defense budget for Ukraine, I shouldn't say out of the defense budget, is all the money that has gone to Ukraine come through supplementals?
Just about. There is some that has come through, but the majority of that, and we're talking, I'm trying to remember what the last number was, but somewhere around $100 billion has been sent to Ukraine. Most of that has been from a supplemental. So the concern is if there isn't another supplemental, if there's not that option on the table for coming, for the coming year, for the coming years, that money will cut into the defense budget. So now we are saying, okay, if you send $10 billion to Ukraine in next year, if that comes out of defense budget, does that mean we've got to cut $10 billion from readiness accounts or procurement accounts or healthcare accounts, whatever else it would be?
The number, according to Senators Kyrsten Sinema and John Kennedy in their op-ed in today's USA Today, $113 billion in aid at this point to Ukraine. They're calling for a special inspector general to oversee this funding, harking back to the special inspector general for Afghanistan reconstruction, appointed in 2008, oversaw a lot of the spending. Can you take us back to SIGAR, I guess is what it was referred to, and how that impacted the Pentagon, how much scrutiny that that was given to the Pentagon when it came to Afghanistan spending, and if they get this, what that would mean for Ukraine spending.
Yeah, look, that scrutiny is still happening. We're still getting reports from SIGAR about wasted money, lost money. You know, a lot of this is money that's not accounted for, not necessarily money that's wasted, but money that was sent out into Afghanistan, given to Afghan National Security Forces, given to, you know, various projects, and then not really tracked. So we don't know if it was something that was successful. We don't know if it's a project that helped the community. We don't know if it's a project that ended up benefiting the Taliban or another outside group. So with the numbers we're seeing with Ukraine, it's the same concerns. You know, where exactly is this money going? Can we say this equipment is going to the right people and is being used by our allies rather than just sitting in a warehouse somewhere, or even worse, you know, going out the door and potentially falling into enemy hands, terrorist hands, some group that would use it improperly. So again, with that amount of money, there's just a lot of worry on Capitol Hill now with, you know, is it being spent properly? Are we getting a bang for the buck? And, you know, are we going to come back later, you know, with an inspector general that says, yeah, actually $50 billion of that really just went nowhere. It didn't help us at all.
On the National Defense Authorization Act, mm-hmm. What's the 101 on this year's bill?
Well, the very first thing is going to be getting it done. So the debt limit conversation, all this negotiation, this has pushed the entire timeline up on Capitol Hill back by a month. Everything was supposed to be started about this time last month. We'll start to see some of the details starting next week. So House Armed Services Committee is going to have their normal markups and go into this. As you said, the authorization bill, This is sort of setting the guidelines for all the financial priorities and the big military policy priorities for the year. We'll see appropriations down the line. That's where they actually get the money. But the Senate will start to do theirs the following week. You know, the big things that I'll be looking for, recruiting has been a major issue. We'll see how that's going to be included in there. I have a feeling that you're going to see two very different visions on there. One from the Democrats saying we need more bonuses, we need more flexibility, we need some more policy issues to entice folks. On the Republican side, it's going to be the woke conversation. It's going to be the conversation about, is there too much diversity, equality, training? Is there too much focus on extremism, things of that sort? And do we need to pull that back in order to stop making the military look bad, to make it more attractive? So on the personnel sides, those are going to be big issues. We already think that the pay raise is going to be a pretty generous one for next year because of inflation over the last few years. You know, the president's budget, the debt limit deal matches roughly the same spending level as what the president outlined there. So that's at least a baseline. We'll be looking to see just where lawmakers are gonna tweak that. Are they gonna want a few more ships, a few more planes, more readiness, more training issues? There's already a pretty sizable number in there increase for the Pacific Defense Initiative. This is money that's directly related to China and sort of bolstering allies in the area, in the region, and trying to make sure to counter some of that Chinese threat. But we've heard from Republicans on the House that they want even more for that. They want even more focus on that because they see China as a threat. So we'll get to see over the next 2 weeks just what the tweaks are and just what the changes are.
That was Leo Shane, deputy editor of the Military Times. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.